I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Hankus Netsky, comes from a family of musicians who play klezmer music. He went on to found the Klezmer Conservatory Band and is credited with reviving and preserving this Jewish folk music, often associated with weddings and funerals. Here's Bukharester Bulgar performed by the band. Hankus Netsky investigated the 20th century roots of this music in Philadelphia for his new book called Klezmer, published by Temple University Press. He dug through the archives, listened to old recordings, and interviewed musicians who knew other musicians to tell the story of this rich and distinctive tradition. We have more songs queued up. Hankus Netsky is chair of contemporary improvisation and director of the Jewish Music Ensemble at the New England Conservatory in Boston. He's collaborated with many artists, including Itzhak Perlman and Theodore Bekel, and it's been about 25 years. Hankus Netsky, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
So great to be back here.
How far back do we have to go to get to klezmer music? I often associate it with Eastern Europe, 19th century music out of the shtetl. But reading your book, I feel like we have to go back even further.
Well, the idea of a musician playing music to entertain really goes back probably to the Bible. And we don't somehow have any recordings of that music. That's the only problem. Otherwise, we would be playing it. But we know that in every case, throughout Jewish history, rabbis very often were trying to prevent this from happening. Because it was more fun, in a sense, than listening to somebody talk. And people wanted to dance. People wanted exciting music. There were a lot of things that came along over the years that really got in the way, but it never went away. And even in difficult times, people insisted on having some kind of music at their parties.
Well, we're going to be listening to a lot of music. And what always strikes me about klezmer music is both its exuberance and this sort of mournfulness, a kind of sadness that's also embedded in perhaps the minor keys or just in the music itself.
Yeah, it seems to really be reflecting the feeling of the people. Every music does. And in the Jewish music, it kind of shrugs and says, oi. And you hear that in the music. It has a Jewish accent. It has a Yiddish accent. And it has irony. So if Jewish comedians are ironic, then the music's going to be ironic.
Your family came to Philadelphia. And as you write in the book, a lot of Jewish families came to the city from Ukraine, from Kiev in particular.
Yeah, the area around Kiev, Philadelphia, Jews trace their roots in huge numbers to the area around Kiev. Although for the music, we also look to Belarus, which is another part of north of Ukraine, very important for the music, just very sophisticated music. So it's a combination of this sort of really fun Romanian and Ukrainian, southern Ukrainian kind of feeling, and then also this very complex idea that came more from the northern areas.
Well, we do have a song queued up. I'm going to have you say it because I will definitely mispronounce it. And this is Bayim. You do it.
Oh, Bayim Rabin in Palestina. Okay. So this is a very – this is a recording from 1929 featuring the Bruder Kapelle, which is a group that probably came here from a town called actually Teplik in Ukraine. And – the characters in this band, as described to me in my interviews, were very colorful. It features a clarinetist named Itzikl Kramfeis, who actually my Uncle Sam played with, and many musicians had legends about this guy, a very crusty old guy who spoke very little English, didn't read any music, but just played incredibly, I would say, the bluesiest klezmer I've ever heard, really just with a heart, with such soul, but also a very thick accent. There's a trumpet player on here, Nachman Grossman, who people say used to play naked in the Schwitz.
meaning the shower?
The place where the ritual baths, right. where people would go. He would, for a little extra money, he'd play a few Freilichs for you. The drummer on this is a guy named Hyman Spector, who I heard, who they called Jaime der Teubel, which meant Jaime the deaf guy. Which is what they said, that's why he plays so loud. But both of his children actually were fantastic percussionists, played in Philly for many years at places like the Earl Theater and many other clubs. So it's actually a very rich view of the Philadelphia klezmer scene in the 1920s.
Well, let's give it a listen. A song from 1929. You mentioned, Hank, is this guy named Cramped Weiss and your Uncle Sam. There's a quote in your book where he says, Itzigal Cramped Weiss was typical of old timers. He'd point to a page with one flat in the signature and say, what key is this? And I'd tell him, it's a key of F. And he'd mimic me, key of F. Ha, he thinks he's so smart. Several times when I worked for him, he refused to pay me. I had to get him thrown out of the union. So was everyone a character?
Well, not everyone, but Cramped Weiss definitely was, and he was a character, but he was quite a virtuoso on the clarinet, and people loved him, and people just loved to hear him play.
I was wondering, too, coming to Philadelphia, which, of course, had its own jazz tradition, classical music, other immigrants that had come to this city as well, how do you see the kind of Jewish music that came from the Ukraine, for instance, how it intersected with all these musical traditions, or did it?
A lot of these guys, actually, when they got to Philadelphia, they were very successful. They would get jobs, for example, with John Philip Sousa. Arthur Pryor was the regional guy who worked for Sousa and led the band at Woolgrove Park. A lot of these guys would be playing Jewish weddings, and then they'd play at Woolgrove Park during the day. In those days, in the teens, until the talking pictures came in, I think it's 1927, these guys had full employment for musicians. You know, they were just working all the time. And we have a percussionist, for example, Jacob Hoffman, who played for the Doily Cart, and he played for the Philadelphia Orchestra also. But he was also on many of these klezmer recordings from the 1920s, and his whole family was also versatile in that way. They could play anything. And that was true of that generation after Cramped Weiss.
After Cramped Weiss. Yeah. Well, let's play another song. This is a Xylophone Doine?
Doine.
Doine, performed by Kendall's Orchestra. And this is featuring Jacob Hoffman. Let's give it a listen.
Thank you.
is terrific. I mean, beautiful xylophone playing and that drone that we hear in the beginning.
Yeah. Oh, it's spectacular. And it's the whole band knowing how to play very, very quietly under that xylophone. And it's really something that with a xylophone to have that much expression and that it feels like it's crying. You know, and it's a xylophone. It's a bunch of pieces of wood.
Right.
But he can really make it make you feel something the way he plays that. And it feels like a cantor. It feels like a cantor kind of doing a really emotional prayer.
Is this the music you grew up hearing then?
Well, I grew up hearing a lot of cantors and great cantors in Philadelphia. Philadelphia had a fantastic cantorial tradition and still does to some extent. And this music is really parallel to that. So,
because it's more secular music. I mean, can we think of it as secular music?
It's hard to know what to talk of, how to talk about Jewish music, whether anything is really secular. I have to say, I mean, as the years go by, I really wonder. People use it for what they want to use it for, but it all comes from the same root and the same feeling, and it comes from a world where everybody knew something about the religion, everybody had a rich ethnic connection, and then they had whatever ideology they had. So people would use it as secular music, I suppose, and they could use it as religious music, and it didn't matter. It was Jewish music. It was an ethnic music.
Well, we're almost up in a break here, but you started the Klezmer Conservatory band, what, 35, 36 years ago, thinking, this will never last. But here you are.
Yeah, I didn't even know we would attract an audience at all. I was actually inspired by an Irish musician here in Philadelphia, by Mick Maloney, who was living here at the time. And he had these wonderful Irish jam sessions at his house, and I knew all this music. So I gathered people together in Boston, and I decided to do what Mick was doing and just spread the music to musicians who would show up and wanted to eat some good food and do a little drinking and play the music. And that's how the band started, and then the audience came.
That's Hank Osnetsky, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're listening to the Klezmer Conservatory Band. He founded it, is the leader of it many years ago. He currently chairs the Contemporary Improvisation Departments at the New England Conservatory, and he's got a new book called Klezmer, Music and Community in 20th Century Jewish Philadelphia. We're going to play some more music after this very short break, and you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. Much more music and conversation after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, Hank Osnetsky is our guest. He is a klezmer musician. He is credited with reviving and preserving this Jewish folk music that goes back who knows where or how far back. And he's got a new book. It is called Klezmer Music and Community in 20th Century Jewish Philadelphia. And he grew up in this region, knows this music very well. Let me have you set up for us. This is Philadelphia Russian Share Part 1. Tell us about this orchestra and what we should listen for.
Well, we're going to hear Kandel's Orchestra. They're the orchestra that was accompanying Jake Hoffman on that doina we heard before, except now Jake is going to move over to the drum set and play with this group. And it's an incredible collection of musicians led by a guy from Krakow, Poland, Harry Kandel, who had an appliance store over on Fifth Street in South Philadelphia, across from Yours Restaurant. And he used to actually rehearse the band, in fact, in Yours Restaurant, apparently.
Wow. And
he assembled a group that were incredibly versatile musicians. And they played one of them, in fact, Charles Gusakoff supposedly was in this. He became one of the heads of Curtis Institute and first trombone of Philadelphia Orchestra eventually. There were just such fabulous musicians in this group, very versatile. The guy who taught Ziggy Elman trumpet was the Portnoy was the trumpet player in this group. So it's a very, very interesting group, and they're going to play a piece which, over the course of about 50 years evolved into a 20-minute medley that every musician who played Jewish weddings in Philadelphia had to know by heart. And it's kind of an incredible thing. I don't think any other city had a medley like this, that it was almost like if you joined a Jewish wedding band, it was like the hazing was, could you play this piece?
By heart.
By heart. And it's very interesting. It moves up in the 20 minutes over the course of 20 minutes. It moves through four different key centers. And it's very structured. It's very interesting how it evolved. The other thing it does, though, that I love is it shows kind of like layers of time. It's like a tapestry. The very first part of it, we have melodies that were brought here by someone named Morris Fried a long time ago from Belarus. Then we have, when it changes key, the music that came here from Romania, from someone named Lemish and the Lemish family. And then we move through other keys and other music. So in this little segment, what Candle does in this little segment in about 3 minutes is he goes through some of the A minor material, some of the A major material, and you can kind of hear how it works as a piece of music. It doesn't repeat. It just evolves over the course of 20 minutes because it's a long dance with lots of figures. So we'll hear a little bit of it.
We'll hear a tiny little bit of it. This is Philadelphia Russian Share. Philadelphia Russian Share Part 1, performed by Kendall's orchestra. What does share mean, Hankus?
A share is a scissors in Yiddish. And it probably means that the steps are like a square dance. And they go back and forth and they form a pattern that looks a little bit like what a scissors does.
Oh, interesting. And we should think of this music as in a sense, what, wedding music? I mean, I know you...
Definitely.
Okay.
In fact, the share is very much identified with the Jewish wedding. At the wedding, once people were settled, each group of eight people would commission the band to play a share. And they'd get up and they'd do a share and it would last 20 minutes. And then some other people would say, oh, they had a share. Well, we got to do a share.
and on and on it would go.
So it was kind of, really for the musicians, it meant a lot of extra tips.
This book is an investigation and exploration of the kind of klezmer music that was created and performed in Philadelphia. Was this stuff written down? When we think about klezmer music, do we think about scores and written down music?
Well, I'm really lucky that a lot of musicians needed non-Jewish musicians in their bands. Therefore, they wrote it down. And therefore, there were manuscripts. And when an older musician was training a younger musician, he'd write him a book because the older musicians never used any music. They knew everything by heart. So luckily, people eventually wrote it down. And we have a lot of I was able to dig up anyway, a lot of evidence of what the music was, what the repertoire was in Philadelphia and what to some extent it still is. And we also have a fair amount number of recordings that tell us what it sounded like. Candle's Orchestra made 93 recordings.
I read that for Victor Recording Machine or Company
originally,
in Camden, right?
Well, originally in New York and then Camden starting in 1923. And once they moved to Camden, the band's there all the time. So it's fascinating.
They had a union. They had a great I guess, misspelling of the union. Oh, I guess it was a music hall, right?
The old union, there was a Jewish union.
Yes.
Which was spelled very funny, yes, like Y-U-N-O. You're right. Yes. When they first came over, they had a uniquely Jewish musicians union. But at the beginning of the 20th century, the musicians union combined with that union, and eventually all the musicians' unions in Philadelphia combined together.
And where are you? You mentioned a couple places.
18th Street.
18th Street. And where would people perform? Let's say in the teens or the 20s, where in Philadelphia would they perform?
Well, especially in the teens, it would be places like Stanton Hall, which is in South Philadelphia. The building's still there, actually.
Wow.
But it's not looking so great. But it would be also the restaurants started coming along, places like Himmelstein's and Yours Restaurant. Then places in North Philadelphia, Girard Avenue was a real area for Jewish commerce in Philadelphia. So the Cornet Restaurant was another one on North Broad Street. Davis the Caterer. I mean, there were so many of these. Cohen, the Golden Slipper Club on Girard Avenue. Again, the building's still there.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. But the building is still there, Golden Slipper Club. And that was a place where people would have their wedding. If they couldn't afford to have a wedding, they'd have two or three weddings at once. And then they'd hire one band and have a big party. So that was a special catering hall.
That's Hank Osnetsky, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's written a new book. It's called Klezmer, and again, Music and Community in 20th Century Jewish Philadelphia. And we have been playing selections from a number of musicians, orchestras here in the Philadelphia area. Also, some of Hank Netsky's band as well. And he is the founder and director of the Klezmer Conservatory Band. And I should add that grew up here in the Philadelphia area. And to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How much was there the impulse to assimilate? Of course, immigrants, this is the how much do you assimilate? How much do you leave behind? How much do you forget? How much do you become, quote unquote, American? And when you look at the music, was there kind of a tension between the old timers that might have come here as immigrants and then their children or their children's friends who might be doing klezmer music?
Well, I experienced that in my own family because my grandfather was a band leader and my mother didn't want any Jewish music at her wedding.
Oh, interesting.
So really, the next generation wanted very much to be American. At the same time, once we started playing, all of a sudden, my mother knew all the dances.
It is hard to sit still when you hear klezmer music.
So it was really fascinating because there was definitely that idea that immigrants had that they wanted to preserve the old country. And in fact, the mothers controlled the wedding. The mothers picked the flowers. The mothers picked the decor. The mothers did everything. As Cal Shaw, one of my friends who was in the business, loves to say, all the bride and groom had to do was show up.
The mother took care of everything. The mother-in-law took care
exactly.
of everything.
If you were dealing with immigrants. Now, once the children took over,
right. They
planned the wedding. And they wanted it to be like they want, like they wanted. And they wanted swing music and they wanted something modern. The other factor that really went into play was, honestly, a de-emphasis in ethnicity.
Meaning?
From the Jewish community. I mean, I think what happens is when Israel is founded in the 40s, Jewish education gets focused on that. So as a kid, I learned Israeli folk dances. I didn't learn the Sher or the Freilichs or the Bulgar. I might see it. I might see people dancing it at Teplitsky's or something when my uncle was playing. But that wasn't what we were being taught. They really substituted in Jewish education. I think it's the only culture that really had this, a new culture that was really not that old ethnic culture. So honestly, I grew up very confused. And I think the reason I do this, the reason I was always looking for this was I couldn't understand how I was being taught to be something different than who my parents were and who my grandparents were. And what happened with this revival is that, in fact, we've put this out there. And now there's a young generation that really wants this stuff, that really wants this, this truly ethnic music. and many other aspects of Jewish culture that came from our parents and grandparents.
Coming full circle.
Yes.
Let's play another song. And this is performed by Jerry Adler, your great uncle Jerry, and Morris Zeft. How do you say what we're going to listen to?
Well, we're going to hear a song written in Philadelphia by a guy named Max Petrovsky, and he wrote it for his wife, and his wife's name was Chaikala. And this is from a party in 1968. So,
wow.
I mean, to me, it's kind of mind-boggling. This was given to me by Alan Shapiro, whose father, Jack Shapiro, is the drummer. And just to think that in 1968, I mean, the Beatles had almost broken up by then, and this is what was going on at a B'nai B'rith Lodge some night in 1968.
Let's give it a listen. A song performed by our guest, great uncle Jerry Adler, Morris Zeft, and we are talking about klezmer music as it was performed, played, and celebrated here in Philadelphia, again with our guest, Hank Osnetsky, author of a new book called Klezmer. We have a comment from Shirley. She says, how can teachers best introduce klezmer to younger students? Any recommendations? I mean, this is your life in many ways.
Stay tuned is what I would say. I'm hoping to get support to put this into Jewish education, and I'm really talking with people about that and how we can do that, how we can get this culture out there and teach it. And we are doing it in one-week workshops. So, in fact, next week I'll be in Canada for something called Klez Canada. It goes an entire week, and people bring their kids, and we give 150 full scholarships to kids from all over the world, and they come and learn the music. That's how it's done at the moment. I'd love to see it taught all kinds of other places and all kinds of other ways, but we'll see.
So who influenced you? I mean, obviously you grew up in this musical family surrounded by this kind of music, but there was this back and forth, I guess, between being Americanized and being an immigrant. So was there a particular member of your family that said, Hankus, you know, you should be a musician, or vice versa? You looked at
no, they generally said you shouldn't be a musician. I mean, a musical family is not necessarily
right.
Going to be. But really, for me, it was the feeling in my father's family, honestly, that pushed me toward it. My father was in the rag business. His company, Quaker Jobbing Company, is still there at 2nd and Columbia.
Wow.
And I was sorting rags with old Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe when I was 4 or 5 years old. I was, you know, trying to divide the wool from the cotton and throw out the polyester. So I mean, it was that ethnic feeling. It was going to the Ambassador restaurant. It was noticing that there was all this rich ethnicity around, you know, and where was the music to go with it?
Uh-huh.
Where was the soundtrack? You know, and that was really what it was. I was wondering what happened. And meanwhile, as I said, in Jewish education, the cantor was still there, but the cantor was struggling to really do what the cantor wanted to do. So I saw that. Mm-hmm. And by the time I was 19, I just needed to know. I had photos of my grandfather's band, and I just wondered, what did they sound like? What was this music? There had to be something besides Havana Gila.
So do you think of yourself as a kind of rag picker now? I mean, going through old music and look, throwing out the polyester, looking for the wool and
that's
cotton?
That's the idea. I mean, my other band is called Hebrew National Salvage, and that's what we do. I have spent as much time as possible just trying to find these treasures. I mean, I worked for 20 years with a Holocaust survivor who passed away last year, learning about the Jewish music traditions from a little tiny farming village with six Jewish families. this guy had a world that was so incredibly rich, and he wanted to pass it on. And we do a lot of that amazing music, and people are just amazed. They say, where did you learn this? Well, it's out there. You know, it just was ignored for 60, 70 years. People will focus on the Holocaust, but they will not focus on what happened before the Holocaust, which is really, honestly, the whole point, I would think, is can we go back and find that stuff that was destroyed? And that's what I do.
And where was this little town, this tiny little town?
It was in the Carpathian Mountains. It was called Upper Remeti. And it was near Beriksatz, near Munkacs. It was these are probably names that mean nothing to a lot of listeners. But it's really a very rich borderland. Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Ukraine all meet in this area. And so everyone spoke all the languages. And the music is so rich from that area. This is also, by the way, where Elie Wiesel came from.
Oh,
and he was another great source of music, by the way.
Indeed. Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, Hankus Netzky is our guest. He's the founder of the Klezmer Conservatory Band, also the author of a new book called Klezmer. It's about the music, the community, the culture of klezmer music and musicians here in the Philadelphia area through the 20th century. And you can join the conversation sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. More music after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Hankus Netzky. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He's a composer, a scholar, teaches improvisation and Jewish music. Also the founder and director of the Klezmer Conservatory Band. He chairs the contemporary improvisation departments at the New England Conservatory. And again, he's got a new book called Klezmer, Music and Community in 20th Century Jewish Philadelphia. Got some comments coming in at radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So how much of klezmer music is improv?
Not that much, really. It's really melodies that are ornamented and that are played in a way that makes them appropriate for being played at a Jewish wedding, and that is improv. I mean, that's the concept people have to understand about improvisation. Jazz has improvisation, and jazz, you reinvent new melodies based on a chord progression. That is brilliant,
yeah.
And it's great, and I love doing it. This is different. This is the art here is to be able to speak a language through the music. You know, otherwise, they're just little dots on a page. They could sound any of 50,000 different ways if you play them in different ways. But the idea is to have the language of a particular culture, a particular kind of ethnic group that communicates in a particular way. And this is the Jewish one.
Would you say that Yiddish music then speaks the Yiddish language? I mean, is the music of Yiddish?
Absolutely. It's the music of Yiddish and Ashkenazic Hebrew, Eastern European Hebrew. I mean, and I focus on Eastern European Jewish music. I love other Jewish music. There are so many kinds from all over the world. You could just say, if you say Jewish music, it just means world music. It could be anything. But that's not the point. For me, it's the ethnic music of over 90% of American Jews, and certainly my own ethnic music. And I teach it to people from all over the world.
We have an email from Eric. Can you talk a little bit about the mix of Jewish and African-American music in your life? And certainly, I would think in Philadelphia, it's such a both such strong traditions.
Well, absolutely. And for me, in fact, I grew up very much in a community where the thing that you aspired to was to be a jazz musician. I mean, when I was a kid, when I was at Leeds Junior High School, the kids in ninth grade, there was this fabulous group, three African-American musicians who brought me into their quartet. And as far as I was concerned, they were professionals at age 14. And that was really what got me playing music. And Philadelphia is just a rich, you know, rich ethnic mix that is incredible. And really, honestly, at that time, the reason I would not have been at that B'nai B'rith party in 1968 and heard my uncle is that would be in the Northeast. That would be in an area that was isolated and still very ethnically Jewish. But Mount Airy was not like that. And on the other hand, klezmer really met jazz in Philadelphia too. And in fact, Candles Orchestra eventually started making jazzy records because that became very popular. By the late 30s, you had Bymir Bis Dushane, which was came from the Yiddish theater and was the most popular song in the country and the biggest hit the country had ever known. And for 4 or 5 years after that, everybody did Jewish music. And Cab Calloway did it. Duke Ellington did it. Everybody did things influenced by this music at that time. And that's a fascinating period.
Well, let's play another piece of music. This is a Yiddish niggun.
Yes.
Niggun, a Jewish melody performed by Bobby Block. Let's listen and then we'll talk about the music and also Bobby Block. We are talking while we're listening to music. And again, our guest is Hank Osnetsky, and that was a Yiddish niggun, a Jewish melody performed by Bobby Block. Bobby Block's still alive.
Bobby Block is alive and well. He lives in Haddonfield, and he books his orchestra. And the amazing thing is that he can get that saxophone to have that Yiddish accent. And that's not a traditional instrument for klezmorim, but my God, when he does that, I don't know anyone else in the world who can do what he does.
So what's the typical instruments we would associate with klezmer music?
Really, the violin and the clarinet, you know, are the main things. And the flute, the saxophone is associated with jazz, but it's just so beautiful. I always give that to my students, you know, because it's like the uncoltrane. You know, it's like they all want to sound one very particular way. And there's Bobby sounding completely different. And the kids will take that and I make them learn that. And then, okay, what can you do with that kind of sound?
Yeah. We have a question from a former band member of yours, Stuart Wilder. He says, how do we get synagogues and schools to get younger musicians interested in this style of music? Picking up on a previous comment that we had, you said Stuart Wilder was your best friend growing up.
Stuart Wilder was the guy who taught me music. I mean, hi, Stuart. It's so great that you're listening. And Stuart Wilder introduced me to Fats Waller and Count Basie and Duke Ellington. And I mean, what a wonderful guy. So really we have this opportunity, I would say. I think we have the interest out there. We have kids who really would love to learn about this. And what it will take is really putting some money into producing maybe videos, instructional videos, getting schools to train teachers, to do teacher training that includes this culture. I mean, Stuart would remember, we went to the same Hebrew school, the day that the principal came in and told us that we're going to not say the word Shabbos anymore. We're going to all say Shabbat from now on. Very interesting, you know, that everything was going to change and whatever we'd learned as children was not going to be relevant. Okay, so we had that for quite a while, and Israel's a wonderful, wonderful place, and this absolutely was essential to have a homeland for these people who were dispossessed. But we have this culture, and this culture was really abandoned and really was put aside, and there's a lot of work to do in education. And I don't mean just Jewish education. I mean it can be out there for everyone, just like, you know, African-American culture is out there for everyone.
Stuart Wilder, thanks for that comment. How about women musicians, klezmer musicians in Philadelphia in the 20th century?
There were very, very few klezmorim. And in fact, here in Philadelphia, we have a woman who was honored by the NEA as a cultural treasure. She got the NEA Cultural Heritage Award, Lane Hoffman Watts. And her story is absolutely amazing. I mean, her father was Jacob Hoffman, who we heard before, a great virtuoso in the world of Jewish music. And his daughter wanted to play the drums.
Right.
And in fact, playing the drums, she became the very first woman admitted to Curtis Institute as a percussionist. She was a fabulous percussionist and still is. When the revival came along, we found out there was Elaine, and Elaine had recordings of herself playing with her father, playing the drum set. But the band leaders in Philadelphia, a woman playing the drums, would be outrageous. So she always ran into problems. Only her father would hire her. And then, of course, she played shows and all kinds of stuff and all kinds of orchestral things. She became the timpanist who had her timpani in the van and would come to play with orchestras all over the state. But Elaine finally has had her day now as a great, great, really the best authority on klezmer drumming.
And I should say to our listeners, she and her daughter were guests on the show a couple of years ago, and maybe we can even post that interview that we did on our Facebook page so people can have a chance to listen to it. We got an email from an anonymous person. How can someone learn dance steps to klezmer? Are there specific dance steps, or is it
very
improv?
Much? No. There's an entire revival of the klezmer dance tradition now, and I'm so delighted because, as I said, as a kid, all they would teach us were these new Israeli dances. Mm-hmm. But there's incredible dances, and just last month, right at the Jewish Museum, we had a concert where Steve Weintraub, who's one of these dance people, as they were dancing, taught people the Russian share. And these dance leaders are brilliant. They have found ways to just go out there and instantly make people do these old Jewish dances. And they're, again, at these various gatherings, like Klez Canada,
right,
or Klezmer New York, or festivals in St. Petersburg and Krakow, people do a lot of dance instruction now. But again, it's not enough. There ought to be It would be nice if it was also in Jewish education instead of just in all of these non-Jewish venues.
I hear you. Let me play another, and this takes us up to more contemporary days. This is a Klingon klezmer, Party at the End of the Universe. Anything you want to say, Hankus, before we listen to this?
Well, Klingon klezmer was founded by Jack Kessler, who at the time was the cantor at Germantown Jewish Center, and now he's more freelance. He's actually the cantorial director of something called the Jewish Renewal Movement, and trains a lot of wonderful young people to continue cantorial tradition. And Jack's band brought together musicians, again, great musicians just from the Philadelphia area, Dave Posmentier, I think, and Stan Slaughter on trumpet, just fabulous group of musicians. And this is contemporary klezmer, really, in Philadelphia.
And this is a Party at the End of the Universe. At the End of the Universe by Klingon Klezmer. Hankus, you include a description of the 6th Annual Intergalactic Jewish Music Festival, November 26, 2000. Can you describe this for us?
I just wanted to show that even in sleepy old Philadelphia, we're not just talking about an old tradition here, that when the Klezmer revival came along, people not only joined that movement, that neo-klezmer movement, but gave it a Philadelphia flavor. So the word intergalactic hooks it up with Sun Ra.
Absolutely.
Very, very own, right? Very directly. And, you know, I grew up, of course, going to Vernon Park, and the band would set up on a Sunday afternoon. You wouldn't even know, they couldn't charge anything. That's where they'd rehearse for 3 hours they'd play until a thunderstorm happened. And sometimes you couldn't tell the thunderstorm from the music. And it was amazing, absolutely amazing. So Philadelphia had its own right to – now, it's kind of interesting, though, because actually what it's doing in Sonny's philosophy, in Sun Ra's philosophy, what he equated his intergalactic thing was African-American identity, was that you might as well be from Saturn, honestly. I mean, that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Can you relate to that?
Well, that's the point. That's what these Jewish musicians were doing. They were saying – if we want to really do our heritage, we might as well be from Saturn. So,
well, I love the names of some of these groups: Warm Purple Gefilte, the Really Lost Tribe Band, Supernova Lox, Nebulae Nebish Noise, the Rabbinical School Dropouts. These were some of the names of the groups.
This was put together by a guy named Ben Laden, not to be confused with Bin Laden, of course. Ben Laden, and he's absolutely brilliant, a great musician here in Philadelphia still. And I saw him do so much wonderful music, and he's the guy who put that together.
We have a question from John. Can Hengist speak to klezmer's influence on surf music of the 1960s?
Well,
do you see it that way?
Well, actually, the surf music in the 1960s, the main progenitor there is Dick Dale, who is Lebanese. And so really, I wouldn't credit klezmer for having an influence on it. However, as soon as Dick Dale comes along, yes, there's Jewish music that sounds like Dick Dale.
We have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye to you. You have performed and are currently performing with Itzhak Perlman. What's that like?
Well, Itzhak has widened the audience, and that's what makes me so confident, in fact, that this music really should be getting to more people. And Itzhak says this to me all the time. I mean, we've played twice at the Hollywood Bowl for over 10,000 people. We play at the Ravinia Festival. We've played at Tanglewood. We played Symphony Hall twice. We've played all over the world. And the audience, it's always sold out. And it's very exciting. And we've done not only klezmer, we've also done Hasidic and cantorial programs with Itzhak. So Itzhak has really been someone who's been putting the music out there so that people can hear. We had 3 PBS specials with Itzhak, in fact. The latest one was called Rejoice. And these specials are broadcast all over the world. So there's a sense, really, that there's a lot going on in this renewal, revival, resurgence, whatever you want to call it. The one place, as I said, where it really needs, and the callers are saying this basically, that how can we teach this? And I teach it at New England Conservatory, which is a little ironic, not at a Jewish institution, but at a great music school. That's how it's being done.
Hengist Netzke, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, founder, director of the Klezmer Conservatory Band, and he's got a new book called Klezmer, Music and Community in 20th Century Jewish Philadelphia. And you're hearing the music of the Klezmer Conservatory Band. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.